From the primer, the arrival of a sinister baron. Bert's disciplinary practices. The plot against the baron. Practical application of ideas gleaned from the primer. Light. Outside the dark castle, Nell's wicked stepmother continued to live as she pleased and to entertain visitors. Every few weeks, a ship would sail over the horizon and anchor in the little bay where Nell's father had once kept his fishing boat. An important fellow would be rowed ashore by his servants and would live in the house with Nell's stepmother for a few days, weeks, or months. In the end, she always got into shouting arguments with her visitors, which Nell and Harve could hear even through the thick walls of the dark castle, and when the visitor had gotten sick of it, he would row back out to his ship and sail away, leaving the wicked queen heartbroken and sobbing on the shore. Princess Nell, who had hated her stepmother at first, came to feel sorry for her in a way, and to realize that the queen was locked into a prison of her own making, even darker and colder than the dark castle itself. One day, a barkentine with red sails appeared in the bay, and a red-headed man with a red beard came to shore. Like the other visitors, he moved in with the queen and lived with her for a time. Unlike the others, he was curious about the dark castle, and would ride up to its gates every day or two, rattle the door handles, and walk all around it, staring at its high walls and towers. In the third week of the man's visit, Nell and Harve were astonished to hear the 12 locks on the gate being opened, one by one. In walked the red-headed man. When he saw Nell and Harve, he was just as astonished as they were.
"Who are you?"
he demanded, in a low, gruff voice. Princess Nell was about to answer, but Harve stopped her.
"You are the visitor here," he said. "Identify yourself."
At this, the man's face turned almost as red as his hair, and he strode forward and struck Harve across the face with his mailed fist.
"I am Baron Jack," he said, "and you may consider that my calling card."
Then, just for spite, he aimed a kick at Princess Nell, but his foot in its heavy metal armor was too slow, and Princess Nell, remembering the lessons Dinosaur had taught her, dodged it easily.
"You must be the two brats the queen told me about," he said. "You were supposed to be dead by now, eaten up by trolls. Well, tonight you shall be, and tomorrow the castle will be mine."
He seized Harve and began to bind his arms with a stout rope. Princess Nell, forgetting her lessons, tried to stop him, and in a flash he had grabbed her by the hair and tied her up as well. Soon both of them were lying helpless on the ground.
"We'll see how well you can fight off the trolls tonight," Baron Jack said,
and giving each of them a slap and a kick just for spite, he strode off through the gate and locked the 12 locks again. Princess Nell and Harve had a long wait until the sun went down and her night friends came to life and untied her and Harve. Princess Nell explained that the evil queen had a new lover who intended to take the dark castle for himself.
"We must fight him," Purple said.
Princess Nell and all the other friends were startled to hear these words, for usually Purple was patient and wise and counseled against fighting. "There are many shades of gray in the world," she explained, "and many times when the hidden way is best. But some things are purely evil and must be fought to the death."
"If he were but a man, I could crush him with one foot," Dinosaur said, "but not during the daytime. And even at night, the queen is a sorceress, and her friends have mickle powers. We will need a plan."
That night, there was hell to pay. Kevin, the boy whom Nell had defeated over tetherball, had learned everything he knew about being a bully from none other than Bert, because Bert had lived with Kevin's mom for a while and might even have been Kevin's dad. So Kevin went to Bert and told him that he'd been beaten up by Harve and Nell acting together. That night, both Harve and Nell got the worst spanking of their lives. It went on so long that finally Mom tried to step in and get Bert to calm down, but Bert slapped Mom across the face and shoved her down on the floor. Finally, Harve and Nell ended up in their room together. Bert was in the living room having a few beers and getting into a burly scud reactive. Mom had run out of the apartment and they had no idea where she was. One of Harve's eyes was swollen shut and one hand was not working. Nell was terribly thirsty, and when she went to pee, it came out red. Also, she had burns on her arms from Bert's cigarettes, and the pain just kept getting worse.
They could sense Bert's movements through the wall, and they could hear the burly scud reactive. Harv could tell when Bert had gone to sleep, because a single-user reactive eventually went into pause mode if the user stopped reacting. When they were sure Bert was sleeping, they stole into the kitchen to get some medicine from the MC. Harv got a bandage for his wrist and a cold pack for his eye, and he asked the MC for something to put on their cuts and burns so they wouldn't get infected. The MC displayed a whole menu of media glyphs for different kinds of remedies. Some of them were premiums, which you had to pay money for, and there were a few freebies. One of the freebies was a cream that came in a tube like toothpaste. They took it back to their room and took turns spreading it on each other's cuts and burns. Nell lay quietly in bed until she could tell that Harv had gone to sleep. Then she got out the young lady's illustrated primer. When Baron Jack came back to the castle the following day, he was angry to find the ropes piled on the ground and no bones cracked and gnawed by trolls. He stormed into the castle with drawn sword, bellowing that he would kill Harv and Princess Nell himself. But entering into the dining room, he stopped in wonderment as he saw a great feast that had been laid out on the table for him. Loaves of brown bread, pots of fresh butter, roasted fowl, a suckling pig, grapes, apples, cheese, broth, and wine. Standing next to the table were Harv and Princess Nell, dressed in servants' uniforms.
"Welcome to your castle, Baron Jack," Princess Nell said. "As you can see, we, your new servants, have prepared a small snack that we hope will be to your liking."
Actually, Duck had prepared all of the food, but as this was the daytime, she had turned back into a little toy, along with all the other night friends. Baron Jack's anger subsided as his greedy eyes traveled over the feast.
"I will try a few bites," he said, "but if any of the food is not perfect, or if you do not serve me to my liking, I'll have your head spiked on the gates of the castle like that."
And he snapped his fingers in Harv's face.
Harv looked angry and was about to blurt out something terrible, but Princess Nell remembered the words of Purple who said that the hidden way was best, and she said in a sweet voice,
"For imperfect service we would deserve nothing better."
Baron Jack began to eat, and such was the excellence of Duck's cooking that once he started he could barely stop himself. He sent Harv and Nell scurrying back to the kitchen again and again to bring him more food, and though he constantly found fault with them and rose from his chair to give them beatings, he had apparently decided that they were worth more to him alive than dead.
"Sometimes he would burn their skin with cigarettes, too," Nell whispered.
The letters changed on the page of the primer.
"Princess Nell's peepee turned red, too," Nell said, "because the Baron was a very bad man, and his real name wasn't Baron Jack. His real name was Bert."
As Nell spoke the words, the story changed in the primer.
"And Harv couldn't use his arm because of the wrist, so he had to carry everything with one hand, and that's because Bert was a bad man, and he hurt it really bad," Nell said.
After a long silence, the primer began to speak again, but the lovely voice of the Vicky woman who told the story sounded thick and hoarse all of a sudden, and would stumble in the middle of sentences. Baron Bert ate all day, until finally the sun went down.
"Bar the doors," said a high squeaking voice, "or the trolls will be after us."
These words came from a little man in a suit and top hat who had just scurried through the doors and was now eyeing the sunset nervously.
"Who is that pipsqueak interrupting my dinner?" roared Baron Bert.
"This is our neighbor," Princess Nell said. "He comes to visit us in the evening. Please let him sit by the fire."
Baron Bert looked a bit suspicious, but at this moment Harv set a delicious strawberry cheesecake in front of him, and he forgot about the little man entirely, until a few minutes later, when the high squeaking voice piped up again.
"There once was a baron named Bert, who was so tough he couldn't be hurt, and could wrestle a bear, but I think, after two or three drinks, like a child, he'd throw up on his shirt."
"Who dares mock the baron?"
bellowed Baron Bert, and looked down to see the new visitor leaning insouciantly on his walking stick and raising a glass as if to toast his health.
"Your Majesty, don't be upset, and please feel free now to get into bed, for it's been a long day, and you're in a bad way, and your trousers you're soon going to wet."
"Bring me a cask of ale,"
shouted Baron Bert,
"and bring another for this upstart, and we'll see who can hold his drink."
Harve rolled two casks of strong ale into the room. Baron Bert raised one to his lips and drained it in a single pull. The little man on the floor then did the same. Two skins of wine were then brought, and once again both Baron Bert and the little man easily finished them. Finally, two bottles of strong liquor were brought, and the Baron and the little man took turns drinking one swallow at a time until the bottles were empty. The Baron was confounded by the small man's ability to drink, but there he stood, upright and sober, while Baron Bert was becoming very drunk. Finally, the little man pulled a small bottle from his pocket and said,
"For a young man, ale is fine, while grown-ups much prefer wine. Liquor's a thing that's fit for a king, but it's kid stuff compared to moonshine."
The little man uncorked the bottle and took a drink, then handed it to Baron Bert. The Baron took one swallow and fell asleep instantly in his chair.
"Mission accomplished," said the little man, sweeping off his top hat with a deep bow, revealing a set of long furry ears, for he was none other than Peter in disguise.
Princess Nell ran back to the kitchen to tell Dinosaur, who was sitting by the fire with a long wooden pole, poking it in the coals and turning it round and round to make the point very sharp.
"He's asleep," she whispered.
Miranda, sitting in her stage at the Parnasse, felt an overwhelming sense of relief as her next line appeared on the prompter. She took a deep breath before she delivered it, closed her eyes, settled her mind, tried to put herself there in the dark castle. She looked deep into Princess Nell's eyes and sold the line with every scrap of talent and technique she had.
"Good," said Dinosaur. "Then the time has come for you and Harve to flee from the dark castle. You must be as stealthy as you can. I will come out later and join you."
"Please get out of there," Miranda thought. "Please run away. Get out of that chamber of horrors where you've been living, Nell, and get to an orphanage or a police station or something, and I will find you. No matter where you are, I'll find you." Miranda had it worked out already. She could compile an extra mattress, put Nell on the floor of her bedroom, and Harve in the living room of her flat. If only she could figure out who the hell they were. Princess Nell hadn't responded. She was thinking, which was the wrong thing to do right now. Get out, get out.
"Why are you putting that stick in the fire?"
"It is my duty to see that the evil Baron never troubles you again," Miranda said, reading from the prompter.
"But what are you going to do with that stick?"
"Please don't do this. It's not the time to ask why," Miranda thought.
"You must make haste," Miranda read, trying once again to sell the line as best she could.
But Princess Nell had been playing with the primer for a couple of years now and had gotten in the habit of asking endless questions.
"Why are you making the stick sharper?"
"This is how Odysseus and I took care of the Cyclops," Dinosaur said. "Shit, it's going all wrong."
"What's Cyclops?" Nell said.
A new illustration grew on the next page, facing the illustration of Dinosaur by the fire. It was a picture of a one-eyed giant herding some sheep. Dinosaur told the story of how Odysseus killed the Cyclops with a pointed stick, just as he was about to do to Baron Bert. Nell insisted on hearing what happened after that. One story led to another. Miranda tried to tell the stories as fast as she could, tried to put a tone of boredom and impatience into her voice, which wasn't easy because she was actually on the verge of panic. She had to get Nell out of that apartment before Bert woke up from his drunk. The eastern sky was beginning to glow.
Shit, get out of there, Nell.
Dinosaur was just in the middle of telling Princess Nell about a witch who turned men into swine, when suddenly, poof, he turned back into a stuffed animal. The sun had come up. Nell was a bit startled by this turn of events, and closed the primer for a while, and sat in the dark listening to Harve wheeze and Bert snore in the next room. She'd been looking forward to the moment when Dinosaur would kill Baron Bert, just as Odysseus had done to the Cyclops. But now it wasn't going to happen. Baron Bert would wake up, realize he'd been tricked, and hurt them worse. They'd be stuck in the dark castle forever. Nell was tired of being in the dark castle. She knew it was time to get out. She opened the primer.
"Princess Nell knew what she had to do," Nell said.
Then she closed the primer and left it on her pillow. Even if she hadn't learned how to read pretty well, she would have had no trouble finding what she wanted just by using the MC's mediaglyphics. It was a thing she'd seen people use in the old passives, a thing she'd seen when Mom's old boyfriend, Brad, had taken her to visit the horse barn in Dovetail. It was called a screwdriver, and you could have the MC make them in all different shapes, long, short, fat, skinny. She had it make one that was very long and very skinny. When it was finished, it made the hissing sound that it always made, and she thought she heard Bert stirring on the sofa. She peeked into the living room. He was still lying there, his eyes closed, but his arms were moving around. His head turned from side to side once, and she could see a glimmer between his half-opened eyelids. He was about to wake up and hurt her some more. She held the screwdriver out in front of her like a lance and ran straight toward him. At the last instant, she faltered. The tool went astray and skidded across his forehead, leaving a trail of red stitches. Nell was so horrified that she dropped it and jumped back. Bert was shaking his head violently back and forth. He opened his eyes and looked right at Nell. Then he put his hand to his forehead and brought it back all bloody. He sat up on the sofa, still uncomprehending. The screwdriver rolled off and bounced on the floor. He picked it up and found the tip bloody, then fixed his eyes on Nell, who had shrunk into the corner of the room. Nell knew that she had done the wrong thing. Dinosaur had told her to run away, and she had pestered him with questions instead.
"I've,"
she said, but her voice came out all dry and squeaky like a mouse's.
"We must fly."
"Yeah, you're gonna fly all right," Bert said, swinging his feet around to the floor. "Right out the fucking window you're gonna fly."
Harv came out. He was carrying his nunchucks under his injured arm and the primer in his good hand. The book hung open to an illustration of Princess Nell and Harv running away from the dark castle with Baron Bert in pursuit.
"Nell, your book talked to me," he said. "It said we should run away."
Then he saw Bert rising from the sofa with the bloody screwdriver in his hand. Harv didn't bother with the nunchucks. He bolted across the room and dropped the primer, freeing his good hand to fling the front door open. Nell, who had been frozen in a nearby corner for some time, shot toward the door like a bolt finally loosed from a crossbow, snatching up the primer as she ran past it. They ran into the hallway with Bert only a few paces behind. The lobby with the elevators was some distance away from them. On impulse, Nell stopped and dropped to a crouch in Bert's path. Harv turned toward her, terrified.
"Nell!"
he cried. Bert's pumping legs struck Nell in the side. He spun forward and landed hard on the hallway floor, skidding for a short distance. This brought him to the feet of Harv, who had turned to face him and deployed his nunchucks. Harv went upside Bert's head a few times, but he was panicked and didn't do a very good job of it. Bert groped with one hand and managed to catch the chain that joined the halves of the weapon. Nell had gotten to her feet by this point and ran up Bert's back. She lunged forward and sank her teeth into the fleshy base of Bert's thumb. Something fast and confusing happened. Nell was rolling on the floor. Harv was dragging her back to her feet. She reached back to snatch up the primer, which she had dropped again. They made it into the emergency stairs and began to skitter down the tunnel of urine, graffiti, and refuse, jumping over the odd slumbering body. Bert entered the stairwell in pursuit, a couple of flights behind them. He tried to make a shortcut by vaulting over the banister as he had seen and done in Ractives, but his drunk body didn't do it as well as a media hero, and he tumbled down one flight, cursing and screaming, now rabid with pain and anger. Nell and Harv kept running. Bert's pratfall gave them enough of a lead to make it to the ground floor. They ran straight across the lobby and into the street. It was the wee hours of the morning, and there was almost no one out here, which was slightly unusual. Normally there would have been decoys and lookouts for drug sellers. But tonight, there was only one person on the whole block, a bulky Chinese man with a short beard and close-cropped hair, wearing traditional indigo pajamas and a black leather skullcap, standing in the middle of the street with his hands stuck in his sleeves. He gave Nell and Harv an appraising look as they ran past. Nell did not pay him much attention. She just ran as fast as she could.
"Nell," Harv was saying, "Nell, look!"
She was afraid to look. She kept running.
"Nell, stop and look," Harv cried.
He sounded exultant. Finally, Nell ran around the corner of a building, stopped, turned, and peeked back cautiously. She was looking down the empty street, past the building where she had lived her whole life. At the end of the street was a big Mediatronic advertising display currently running a big Coca-Cola ad in the ancient and traditional red used by that company. Silhouetted against it were two men, Bert and the big round-headed Chinese man. They were dancing together. No, the Chinese man was dancing. Bert was just staggering around like a drunk. No, the Chinese man was not dancing, but doing some of the exercises that Dojo had taught Nell about. He moved slowly and beautifully, except for some movements when every muscle in his body would join into one explosive movement. Usually these explosions were directed toward Bert. Bert fell down, then struggled up to his knees. The Chinese man gathered himself together into a black seed, rose into the air, spun around, and unfolded like a blooming flower. One of his feet struck Bert on the point of his chin and seemed to accelerate all the way through Bert's head. Bert's body fell back to the pavement like a few gallons of water sloshed out of a bucket. The Chinese man became very still, settled his breathing, adjusted his skullcap and the sash on his robe. Then he turned his back to Nell and Harv and walked away down the middle of the street. Nell opened her primer. It was showing a picture of Dinosaur, seen in silhouette through a window in the dark castle, standing over the corpse of Baron Bert with a smoking stake in his claws. Nell said, "The little boy and the little girl were running away to the land beyond." Hackworth departs from Shanghai. His speculations as to the possible motives of Dr. X. Would-be passengers skidded to a halt on the saliva-slickened floor of the Shanghai aerodrome as the announcer brayed the names of great and ancient Chinese cities into his microphone. They set bags down, shushed children, furrowed brows, cupped hands around ears, and pursed lips in utter bewilderment. None of this was made any easier by the extended family of some 24 just-arrived boers, women in bonnets and boys in heavy, coarse farmer's pants, who had convened by one of the gates and begun to sing a hymn of thanksgiving in thick, hoarse voices. When the announcer called out Hackworth's flight, San Diego, with stops in Seoul, Vladivostok, Magadan, Anchorage, Juneau, Prince Rupert, Vancouver, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Santa Barbara, and Los Angeles. He apparently decided that it was beneath his dignity, above his abilities, or both, to speak Korean, Russian, English, French, Coast Salish, and Spanish in the same sentence. And so he just hummed into the microphone for a while as if, far from being a professional announcer, he were a shy, indifferent vocalist hidden within a vast choir. Hackworth knew perfectly well that hours would pass before he actually found himself on an airship, and that having achieved that milestone, he might have to wait hours more for its actual departure. Nonetheless, he had to say goodbye to his family at some point, and this seemed no worse a time than any other. Holding Fiona, so big and solid now, in the crook of one arm, and holding hands with Gwen, he pushed insistently across a riptide of travelers, beggars, pickpockets, and entrepreneurs trading in everything from bolts of real silk to stolen intellectual property. Finally, they reached a corner where a languid eddy had separated itself from the flow of people and where Fiona could safely be set down. He turned first to Gwen. She still looked as stunned and vacant as she had, more or less consistently, since he told her that he had received a new assignment, whose nature I'm not at liberty to disclose, save to say that it concerns the future, not merely of my department nor of John Zaibatsu, but of that file into which you had the good fortune to have been born, and to which I have sworn undying loyalty, and that he was making a trip of indefinite duration to North America. It had been increasingly clear of late that Gwen simply didn't get it. At first, Hackworth had been annoyed by this, viewing it as a symptom of hitherto unevidenced intellectual shortcomings. More recently, he had come to understand that it had more to do with emotional stance. Hackworth was embarking on a quest of sorts here, real boy's own paper stuff, highly romantic. Gwen hadn't been raised on the proper diet of specious adventure yarns and simply found the whole concept unfathomable. She did a bit of rote sniffling and tear wiping, gave him a quick kiss and hug, and stepped back, having completed her role in the ceremony with nothing close to enough histrionics. Hackworth, feeling somewhat disgruntled, squatted down to face Fiona. His daughter seemed to have a better intuitive grasp of the situation. She'd been up several times a night recently, complaining of bad dreams, and on the way to the aerodrome she had been perfectly quiet. She stared at her father with large red eyes. Tears came to Hackworth's eyes, and his nose began to run. He blew his nose plangently, held the handkerchief over his face for a moment, and composed himself. Then he reached into the breast pocket of his overcoat and drew out a flat package, wrapped up in mediatronic paper of spring wildflowers bending in a gentle breeze. Fiona brightened up immediately, and Hackworth could not help chuckling, not for the first time, at the charming susceptibility of small people to frank bribery. "You will forgive me for ruining the surprise," he said, "by telling you that this is a book, my darling. A magic book. I made it for you because I love you, and could not think of a better way to express that love. And whenever you open its pages, no matter how far away I might be, you will find me here."
"Thank you ever so much, Father," she said,
taking it with both hands, and he could not help himself from sweeping her up in both arms and giving her a great hug and a kiss.
"Goodbye, my best beloved. You will see me in your dreams," he whispered into her tiny, flawless ear,
and then he set her free, spun around, and walked away before she could see the tears that had begun to run down his face. Hackworth was a free man now, wandering through the aerodrome in an emotional stupor, and only reached his flight by participating in the same flock instinct that all the natives used to reach theirs. Whenever he saw more than one Gwelo heading purposefully in one direction, he followed them, and then others started following him, and thus did a mob of foreign devils coalesce among 100 times as many natives. And finally, 2 hours after their flight was supposed to leave, they mobbed a gate and climbed aboard the airship Hanjin Tacoma, which might or might not have been their assigned vessel, but the passengers now had a sufficient numerical majority to hijack it to America, which was the only thing that really counted in China. He had received a summons from the Celestial Kingdom. Now he was on his way to the territory still known vaguely as America. His eyes were red from crying over Gwen and Fiona, and his blood was swarming with nanocytes, whose functions were known only to Dr. X. Hackworth had lain back, closed his eyes, rolled up his sleeve, and hummed, "Rule Atlantis," while Dr. X's physicians, at least he hoped they were physicians, shoved a fat needle into his arm. The needle was fed by a tube that ran directly into a special fitting on the matter compiler. Hackworth was plugged directly into the feed. Not the regulation Atlantan kind, but Dr. X's black market kludge. He could only hope that they'd given it the right instructions, as it would be a shame to have a washing machine, a mediatronic chopstick, or a kilo of China white materialize in his arm. Since then, he'd had a few attacks of the shivers, suggesting that his immune system was reacting to something Dr. X had put in there. His body would either get used to it, or, preferably, destroy the offending nanocytes. The airship was a Dromund, the largest class of non-cargo vessel. It was divided into 4 classes. Hackworth was 2nd from the bottom, in 3rd. Below that was steerage, which was for migrating theets and for skygirls, prostitutes of the air. Even now, these were bribing their way past the conductors and into the 3rd-class lounge, making eyes at Hackworth and the white-shirted Sarara men who tended to travel this way. Those gentlemen had grown up in one crowded dragon or another, where they knew how to generate a sort of artificial privacy field by determinedly ignoring each other. Hackworth had arrived at the point where he frankly didn't care, and so he stared directly at these men, frontline soldiers of their various microstates, as each one primly folded his navy blue suit jacket and elbow-crawled into a coffin-like microcabin, like a GI squirming under a roll of concertina wire, accompanied or not by a camp follower. Hackworth pointlessly wondered whether he was the only one of this ship, some 2,000 passengers, who believed that prostitution, or anything, was immoral. He did not consider this question in a self-righteous way, more out of rueful curiosity. Some of the skygirls were quite fetching. But as he dragged his body into his microberth, he suffered another attack of the shivers, reminding him that even if his soul had been willing, his flesh was simply too weak. Another possible explanation for the chills was that Dr. X's nanocytes were seeking out and destroying the ones that HM Joint Forces had put in there, waging a turf war inside his body, and his immune system was doing overtime trying to pick up the carnage. Hackworth unexpectedly fell asleep before the Droman had even pulled away from her mooring mast, and had dreams about the murderous implements he had seen magnified on Dr. X's Mediatron during his first visit. In the abstract, they were frightening enough. Having a few million of them in his veins didn't do much for his peace of mind. In the end, it wasn't as bad as knowing your blood was full of spirochetes, which people used to live with for decades. Amazing what a person could get used to. When he settled into bed, he heard a small chime like fairy bells. It was coming from the little pen dangling from his watch chain, and it meant that he had mail. Perhaps a thank-you note from Fiona. He couldn't sleep anyway, and so he took out a sheet of mediatronic paper and spoke the commands that transferred the mail from the pen charm onto the page. He was disappointed to note that it was printed, not handwritten, some kind of official correspondence and not, unfortunately, a note from Fiona. When he began to read it, he understood that it wasn't even official. It wasn't even from a human. It was a notification sent back to him automatically by a piece of machinery he had set into motion 2 years ago. The central message was wreathed in pages of technical gibberish, maps, graphs, and diagrams. The message was, "The young lady's illustrated primer has been found." It was accompanied by an animated three-dimensional map of New Chuzan, with a red line drawn across it, starting in front of a rather seedy-looking high-rise apartment building in the leased territory called Enchantment, and making its way erratically around the island from there. Hackworth laughed until his neighbors pounded on the adjoining walls and asked him to shut up. Nell and Harve at large in the leased territories. Encounter with an inhospitable security pod. A revelation about the primer. The leased territories were too valuable to leave much room for nature, but the geotechs of Imperial Tectonics Limited had heard that trees were useful for cleaning and cooling the air, and so they had built in green belts along the borders between the sectors. In the first hour that they lived free in the streets, Nell glimpsed one of those green belts, though it looked black at the time. She broke away from Harve and ran toward it, down a street that had developed into a luminescent tunnel of mediatronic billboards. Harve chased her, just barely matching her speed, because he had gotten a worse spanking than she had. They were almost the only people on the street, certainly the only ones moving purposefully, and so, as they ran, the messages on the billboards pursued them like starving wolves, making sure they understood that if they used certain ractives or took certain drugs, they could rely on being able to have sex with certain unrealistically perfect young persons. Some of the billboards made an even more elemental pitch, selling the sex directly. The mediatrons on this street were exceptionally large, because they were made to be seen clearly from the heaths, bluffs, terraces, and courts of the New Atlantis clave miles up the mountain. Unremitting exposure to this kind of thing produced mediatron burnout among the target audience. Instead of turning them off and giving people a break for once, the proprietors had joined in an arms race of sorts, trying to find the magic image that would make people ignore all the other adverts and fix raptly on theirs. The obvious step of making their mediatrons bigger than the others had been taken about as far as it could go. Quite some time ago, the content issue had been settled. Tits, tires, and explosions were the only things that seemed to draw the notice of their supremely jaded focus groups, though from time to time they would play the juxtaposition card and throw in something incongruous, like a nature scene or a man in a black turtleneck reading poetry. Once all the mediatrons were 100 feet high and filled with tits, the only competitive strategy that hadn't already been pushed to the red line was technical tricks. Painfully bright flashes, jump cuts, and simulated 3D phantoms that made bluff charges toward specific viewers who didn't seem to be paying enough attention. It was down a mile-long gallery of these stimuli that Nell made her unexpected breakaway, looking from Harve's increasingly distant point of view like an ant scuffling across a television screen with the intensity and saturation turned all the way up, violently changing course from time to time as she was menaced by a virtual pitch demon lunging at her from the false parallax of a moving Z-buffer, flaring like a comet against a bogus firmament of video black. She knew that they were fake, and in most cases didn't even recognize the products they were pitching, but her life had taught her everything about dodging. She couldn't not dodge. They hadn't figured out a way to make the adverts come at you head-on, and so she maintained a roughly consistent direction down the middle of the street until she vaulted an energy-absorbing barrier at its end and vanished into the forest. Harve followed her a few seconds later, though his arm didn't support vaulting, and so he ended up hurtling ignominiously over the top like a hyped auto skater who hadn't seen the barrier at all, just body-kissed it full tilt.
"Nell!"
he was already hollering, as he came to rest in a nest of colorful discarded packaging materials.
"You can't stay in here! You can't stay in the trees, Nell!"
Nell had already worked her way deep into the woods, or as deep as you could get in a narrow green belt made to separate one leased territory from another. She fell down a couple of times, and banged her head on a tree, until with childish adaptivity, she realized that she was on one of those surfaces that wasn't flat like a floor, street, or sidewalk. The ankles would actually have to show some versatility here. It was like one of those places she had read about in the Illustrated Primer. A magical zone, where the fractal dimension of the terrain had been allowed to struggle off the pin, bumps supporting smaller copies of themselves, repeat until microscopic, throw dirt over it, and plant some of those creepy new Douglas firs that grow as fast as bamboo. Nell soon encountered a big Doug that had blown down in a recent typhoon, popping its own root ball out of the ground and thereby excavating a handy depression that invited nestling. Nell jumped in. For a few minutes, she found it strangely hilarious that Harv could not find her. Their flat had only two hiding places, both closets, and so their traditional exploits in the hide-and-go-seek field had provided them with minimal entertainment value and left them wondering what the big deal was anyway about that stupid game. But now, here in the dark woods, Nell was beginning to get it.
"Do you give up?"
she finally said, and then Harv found her. He stood at the edge of the root ball pit and demanded that she come out. She refused. Finally, he clambered down, though to an eye more critical than Nell's, it might have looked as if he were falling. Nell jumped into his lap before he could get up.
"We gotta go," he said. "I want to stay here. It's nice," Nell said.
"You ain't the only one who thinks so," Harv said. "That's why they got pods here."
"Pods?"
"Aerostats for security."
Nell was delighted to hear it, and could not fathom why her brother spoke of security with such dread in his voice. A soprano turbojet seemed to bear down on them, fading in and out as it tacked through the flora. The creepy afflatus dopplered down a couple of notes as it came to a stop directly above them. They couldn't see more than the odd glint of colored light, picked up by whatever it was from the distant mediatrons. A voice, flawlessly reproduced and just a hair too loud, came out of it.
"Visitors are welcome to stroll through this park at any time. We hope you've enjoyed your stay. Please inquire if you need directions, and this unit will assist you."
"It's nice," Nell said.
"Not for long," Harv said. "Let's get out of here before it gets pissed."
"I like it here."
Bluish light exploded out of the aerostat. They both hollered as their irises convulsed. It was hollering right back at them.
"Allow me to light your way to the nearest exit."
"We're running away from home," Nell explained,
but Harv was scrambling up out of the hole, yanking Nell behind him with his good hand. The thing's turbines screeched briefly as it made a bluff charge. In this fashion, it herded them briskly toward the nearest street. When they had finally climbed over a barrier and gotten their feet back on concreta firma, it snapped off its light and zoomed off without so much as a fare thee well.
"It's okay, Nell, they always do that."
"Why?"
"So this place don't fill up with transients."
"What's that?"
"That's what we are now," Harv explained.
"Let's go stay with your buds,"
Nell said. Harv had never introduced Nell to any of his buds before. She knew them only as children of earlier epochs knew Gilgamesh, Roland, or Superman. She was under the impression that the streets of the leased territories were rife with Harv's buds, and that they were, more or less, all-powerful. Harv's face squirmed for a while, and then he said,
"We gotta talk about your magic book."
"The Young Lady's Illustrated Primer?"
"Yeah, whatever it's called."
"Why must we talk about it?"
"Huh?"
Harv said in the dopey voice he affected whenever Nell talked fancy.
"Why do we gotta talk about it?"
Nell said patiently.
"There's something I never told you about that book. But I gotta tell you now," Harv said. "Come on, let's keep moving or some creep's gonna come hassle us."
They headed toward the main street of Lazy Bay Town, which was the leased territory into which the pod had ejected them. The main street curved along the waterfront, separating a beach from a very large number of drinking establishments fronted with lurid, bawdy mediatrons.
"I don't want to go that way," Nell said,
remembering that last gauntlet of electromagnetic pimps. But Harv grabbed her wrist and hobbled downhill, pulling her behind.
"It's safer than being in the back streets.
Now let me tell you about that book. My buds and I pinched it and some other stuff from a Vicky we rolled. Doc told us to roll him.
Doc?
This Chinese guy who runs the flea circus. He said we should roll him and make sure we made it good so he'd get picked up on the monitors.
What does that mean?
Oh, never mind. He also said he wanted us to lift something from this Vicky, a certain package about yay big. Har formed right angles with his thumbs and index fingers and defined the vertices of a rectangle, book size. Gave us to understand it was valuable. Well, we didn't find any such package. We did find a shitty old book on him, though. I mean, it looked old and fine, but no one reckoned it could be the thing Doc was looking for, since he's got lots of books. So I took it for you. Well, a week or two later, Doc wants to know where is the package, and we told him this story. When he heard about that book, he flipped and told us that the book and the package were one and the same. By that time, you were already playing with that book all night and all day, Nell, and I couldn't bear to take it away from you. So I lied. I told him I threw the book down on the sidewalk when I saw it was junk, and if it wasn't still there, then someone else must have come along and picked it up. Doc was pissed, but he fell for it. That's why I never brought my buds to the flat. If anyone finds out you still have that book, Doc'll kill me.
What should we do?
Harv got a look on his face like he'd rather not talk about it. For starters, let's get some free stuff. They took a sneaky and indirect route to the waterfront, staying as far as possible from the clusters of drunks winding through the constellation of incandescent bordellos like cold, dark clumps of rock wending their way through a bright nebula of young stars. They made their way to a public MC on a street corner and picked out items from the free menu, boxes of water and Nutribroth, envelopes of sushi made from nano surimi and rice, candy bars, and packages about the size of Harv's hand festooned with implausible block-letter promises, reflects 99% of infrared, that folded out into huge, crinkly, metallized blankets. Nell had been noticing a lot of rough shapes strewn around on the beach like giant chrome-plated larvae. Must be fellow transients wrapped up in these self-same. As soon as they had scored the goodies, they ran down to the beach and picked out their own spot. Nell wanted one closer to the surf, but Harv made some very well-considered observations about the inadvisability of sleeping below high tide. They trudged along the seawall for a good mile or so before finding a relatively abandoned bit of beach and wrapped themselves up in their blankets there. Harv insisted that one of them had to stay awake at all times to act as a sentry. Nell had learned all about this kind of thing from her virtual adventures in the Primer, and so she volunteered to stay up first. Harv went to sleep pretty soon, and Nell opened up her book. At times like this, the paper glowed softly, and the letters stood out crisp and black, like tree branches silhouetted against a full moon.